Hello there. Welcome back to the TTP Field Manual Podcast. This is our book club episode, a monthly installment where we definitely spoil the novel we're talking about. That's your only warning. Today, Johnny's here with me to discuss the Horace Heresy novel, Dropside Massacre, by John French, performed by Jonathan Keyborn on audiobook format. Released at the end of last year. How are you doing, Johnny? And how did you enjoy this book?
Hey, I heard you like Bolter Porn.
Not overly, but...
Well, boy oh boy, do I have the book for you if you do.
It can scratch an itch. Is it this one?
It sure is. How you doing today?
Yes, good, mate. Good. Definitely a little sleepy at the end of a big week, but I don't have to tell you about that too.
Oh, same. I'm not a late night person, but last night was definitely a late night kind of night.
Thrashing out in the mosh pits there, Johnny.
Yeah, I'm too old for that stuff nowadays. I learnt that last night.
Shaka bra.
Feeling sore.
Did you give it a good mosh? Were you in the pits? Were you wall of deathing?
I wasn't wall of deathing, but I was definitely in the pits.
Hell yeah. You know what I was doing? I was in bed reading a book with a cup of tea.
Oh, what book was it? Would it happen to be this one?
No, because I don't need to be in bed to listen to my audiobook. I was actually in bed reading 500 Worlds Titus. How exciting. But we're here talking about Dropside Massacre. And you've already pointed out something leading into your impressions of it. Hey, you like Bolter Porn? Which leads me to think that you were not so hot on this one.
This book was fine. I'm definitely more of a, like, intrigue and character development kind of guy, and there wasn't a huge amount of this in there. But, I mean, I still had a good fun time listening to it. Can't complain. I mean, I can, and I will.
I mean, with everything you review, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? And
yeah,
of course,
yeah.
It's subjective to you. This was an extremely well-received novel by the community.
And very well-written.
To get into the, I guess, logistics of it, the author of this is John French. John French is well-known for his Ahriman saga within 40K, within the Horus Heresy. He's responsible for a couple of the later novels, such as Praetorian of Dawn and Slaves to Darkness, but hasn't actually written one of these books that usually get slotted a bit earlier in the timeline, from what I can remember. When this book takes place is very much, I would say, simultaneous with the last third or so of Fulgrim.
Yeah, yep, for sure.
At the same time, this book has a lot of characters from across most of the legions. At least the ones present for the massacre. And so I feel like there's more in it having read other novels. Like, if you know a bit more about the World Eaters, or especially the Alpha Legion in this case, maybe some Raven Guard, you'd probably get a little bit more out of it. But at the same time, as you said, it's not super character explorative, I suppose is a good word for it.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I did really like this book, and it was a good fun read. There was a lot going on. Like, a lot going on. I just feel like it fell into a little bit of a trap, I guess is the easiest way to put it.
So did Three Legions, Johnny.
They sure did. You're not wrong.
What type of trap are you referencing, though? What do you feel like this book stumbled into doing?
To put it very plain and simple, after reading Fulgrim, I was very excited for this book. I was the last part of Fulgrim that focused on the Dropside Massacre was a very well done scene to show, like, what was happening, the different forces landing and how they turned success into failure and failure into success and all of that. And I think that third of a book was perfect amount of Dropside Massacre, because it didn't focus heavily on the Bolter Porn and focus more on the characters involved, especially Ferris Manus and Fulgrim, and seeing, like, a lot of emotions. Whereas the only emotions that I seemed to get out of this book was regret.
Yep. There's a lot of regret.
Yeah, and I just felt like the first part of the book was kind of the same lines being spoken just by different people, as they kind of focused on the regret aspect and the why are we doing this and we really shouldn't be doing this, but why? But we have to sort of vibe from both sides, which I get it. Like, you're really trying to push that narrative of, like, this was not a conflict that should have happened. This is not a conflict anyone expected to happen. And everyone is there, not necessarily by choice, but by obligation in their eyes. And that was very good. That was very strong. But hearing it parroted like 5 times in a row from different perspectives really pushed my limits. Frankly, I think this book would have been another one that would have been a lot better to read physically as opposed to listen to, because a lot of the names are very similar. And there was a lot of times when I was reading this book where I was like, hold on, who's talking? Wait, which character is that? Oh, that's the Alpha Legion guy. Oh, that's a World Eater.
Do you want Appius? Do you want Cassian? Do you want Castamon?
Yeah.
Do you want Acronis? Who do you want?
And that's
Hesperides?
I think if I had the words in front of me, it would have been a lot easier to connect with some of these names personally. Kind of struggled with that a little bit where I was like, oh, they're saying this again. Oh, no, that's someone else saying the same three.
To quoth the raven, should we do this, Ferris?
But we will. But there was some interesting moments, and there was definitely like some weird and wacky things going on in the background, especially if you're an Alpha Legion fan.
I really am an Alpha Legion fan. Or am I? Do we want to? So we talked a little bit about our first impressions from your side, a little bit of the who and the what, a little bit of the writing style, the narration. Do we want to, because this book does contain many points of view and some very distinct parts to its narrative being four, do we want to sort of gloss through it like our early HH reviews by going sort of beat by beat, talking about the four parts in order, and then maybe circle back around to certain characters if we haven't glossed over them?
I think that is a good idea for this book.
Okay. I'll chuck in my overall impressions before we get into it, just so we sort of know where we're both standing with this. I came into it cautiously because, to me, this book screams new edition tie-in novel.
Oh, for 30K?
Yeah, for 30K, but it did release a bit later, so I was like, oh, well, you know, maybe.
It might have been one of those ones that got pushed down the pipeline accidentally.
Yeah, like I've read a 40K tie-in novel, I read a Age of Sigmar tie-in novel, and whilst those novels have been quite serviceable, they really felt like a very descriptive catalogue.
Yep.
Every model in a box ends up there, and this book does that to an extent. I giggle to myself anytime a character's like, and oh, there was a Sicaran battle tank next to the Kratos battle tank, and I'm like, yep.
Yep.
All right. And what other tank was there? Oh, they drove up in their Fellblade. I'm like, oh, yep, there it is.
Hey, the Fellblade was cool, all right? That was like a whole character, that tank.
Yeah. But with that said, I think this book was better than what I was expecting. There were some weak components to it, in my opinion, that brought it down for me overall. But especially at first, this first part, the whole setting the scene of the book to come, really excited me. Every little vignette was small and excited me, like how the start of a Game of Thrones season is. You know, all the various players are choosing their moments and making their plans and talking to their allies behind closed doors. And you know something's bubbling, but it's going to take you till the end of the season for the big fight.
Yep.
So the first part of this book, I'm like, yeah. And then when it got to the midpoint, I'm like, okay.
Yep. Yeah. No, I definitely get that vibe.
The first part of the book takes place basically with the Imperium reacting to the fact that Horus has betrayed the Imperium. And as far as they are aware, he's got three traitors with him, Mortarion, Angron, and Fulgrim. And so Dorne and Valdor and Malkador, a couple of other important people are there, and they're like, basically coming to reality, really making a bittersweet acknowledgement of reality that their warriors have turned against them. They have to deal with it. And then the next few parts, multiple characters, and it feels very poetic. There's the astropath scene. There's Corvus Corax getting all of his ships together. Malagurs looking out over the fields of battle to be. It just felt very ephemeral to me, which I really liked. How'd you enjoy the start of the book?
The start of the book was, honestly, it was pretty good. Like, it hadn't hit the point where we were repeating ourselves yet. There was a lot of setup. It felt like it was going to be a really dramatic book, the way everyone was, like, putting the chess pieces in place. The way they described the way the astropaths communicate and predict things was very cool, with the different art styles of each person kind of seeing the warp a little differently, and them going really in-depth and describing, like, how they try and put their messages together and send them off. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, the entire book was written with more of that sort of poetic flair, with that really sort of dreamy description, like how they did with the astropaths. And they do a couple of moments like that again.
Yeah.
But I think a few of the perspectives take away from that writing energy that excited me in the beginning in favor of the more conventional style of a heresy novel. Not bad, just not quite what had got me going in the first place. But for me, what really started to drag me back down into that sort of begrudgingly, like, oh, I'm not too interested now, but I have to kind of get through it because I said I would. And it was that second part, the sort of preparation of the traitors, where you're having Horus, which was good to see Horus in a few more scenes. He's usually just a bit more whispered about, not really in some of these extra novels. It was really nice to see Horus come back into it a bit. Angron's doing his thing, and like Malagurs is doing his thing. A lot of plotting about that I just kind of didn't care for. And there was two really big asterisks in this plot of, I just don't care right now. Emphasis on right now. Why, Johnny, did we get Khan being sad and Fabius just doing Fabius things for so much of this book? I know, like, it's not a huge amount of this book, but in, like, this book where you've got all these Primarchs hanging out together, why? We got, like, fuck all about Mortarion.
Wait, was Mortarion there?
Yeah, exactly. But boy, howdy, do we learn about Fabius Bile and Appius Calpurnius.
Oh, mate. The Fabius Bile bits were great. What do you mean? My boy was doing his thing.
It was really good for Fabius.
Yeah, good Fabius novel.
But by now, I've had Fabius. I've had Emperor's Children. You could give me a bit more of, I don't know, at least the characters on the cover. Give me some more Ferris. Give me some more Corvus. Who's the other fella? Vulcan, he's there. give me a bit more of them, or a bit more of the traits. Like, the Angron component was, I felt really cool. Angron was very distraught by the subterfuge of their actions. He'd rather just say, hey, we're rebelling, come fight us over it, rather than ambush his brothers with other brothers. All that stuff I thought was quite fun. He was willing to throw down with Fulgrim. Mortarion threatened Angron if he didn't back down. I was like, this is kind of fun. I think we had, what, 3 or 4 moments of Khan being like, teeth clacking, can't control my arm, I'm angry all of a sudden, I'm having a vision of fighting somebody. Oh, wait, it really was just a vision. I didn't actually do it yet. Come on. can we steer a little bit towards some other characters? Was what I was thinking for a lot of that part. What do you think?
I wasn't a big fan of Khan. I get what they were trying to do, like trying to build up his resistance and, you know, trying to make us feel bad for the big scary betrayer himself. The Fabius stuff, it was fun to see my boy doing some stuff, but it was definitely a very large part of the novel without much of a gain out of it. Like, you could have left it out and it wouldn't have changed anything.
The payoff of Fabius didn't require Fabius chapters.
Yeah, exactly, because it was really focused on him building up the noise marines and his experimentation. While it's very important that that's what he was doing at that point in time, I think Dropsite Massacre could have, like, he could have had his own book about that or something and done it that way and focused more on what we all wanted to see, which was the Primarchs. As you said, like, Horus was very active in this first portion of the book, and honestly, I was really glad to see how they wrote him. The charisma was dripping. Felt like Horus wasn't just some evil guy. Yeah, we're doing this, and you'll follow me because, frankly, I'm the favorite son. Like, he had all the confidence to do what he needed to do, but also there was, you know, a little bit of, I've said it before, but regret in there. Like, he didn't want to really do it, but it was necessary to get the cause done. He felt like the leader of a rebellion, not some evil god-worshipping lunatic.
Which he definitely becomes more of later, from what I've gathered. So it's nice to see the start of his craziness.
Yeah. As you said, there were some characters that didn't have a lot of say in what was going on. Mortarion and Vulcan come to mind. Every scene Vulcan was in, though, I was like, this guy is cool, though. He was always the voice of reason. He was always just like, I don't think we should do this, but I've got your back. And he was always like, we shouldn't be rushing this. We should be trying to work out what the hell's going on beforehand. And then Ferris is just like, no, I'm angry at Fulgrim. Let me go fight.
Speaking of Ferris, though, I will say that whilst he definitely disappears later in the book to go appear in Fulgrim,
goes to the side project.
He goes back to the main plot retroactively, like 20 years ago, IRL. Did Fulgrim come out like 20 years ago? Anyway, so this whole preparation, I thought, put Ferris in a really cool light. It's not something that's often explored, at least in what we've covered for the pod, but Ferris is extremely capable. He is, I think it's mentioned in his Primarch novel, that maybe a third of the early Great Crusade victories was because of him. Like, he's an extremely competent war general, but he's got fuck all charisma. And so a lot of people in the traders as well really respect Ferris Manus, and that's why they wanted Fulgrim to corrupt him in the first place, because he's so potent. And you can see
he's
it
competent,
with Yeah, you can see it with all of the machinations of his plan, had weighed up all the variables. Corvus and Vulcan are like, you know, we don't have to do it. He's like, logistically speaking, if we don't do this now, we're going to be worse off later. So, you know, sure, we're going to lose some, but we
got
to do
it. Seven or eight legions, and he's got four legions. Now is our best chance to overrun them.
Yeah.
Because at this point in the book, you have to remember, like, as far as the loyalists know, there's eight of them going to this planet. They've got half the forces of the Imperium, basically, going to this war zone to stop the four traitors.
Yeah, absolutely. And from the perspective of the three that were already here, Corvus, Vulcan, Ferris, it was already unheard of or unthinkable that four Primarchs in their legions would turn traitor. To think that four more were in secret cahoots was not even something that crossed their mind.
Yeah.
Dorn himself wanted to throw Perdurabo a bone and let him command the second wave. You know, because he didn't expect Perdurabo had become so bitter he would turn tail. The Night Lords were censured for being a little crazy, but no one knew how crazy and murderous they had become. The Word Bearers were censured for their whole faith-based compliance campaigns, but no one knew they had gone on a side quest into the warp and made contact with demons. No one knew this. And the Alpha Legion, well, everyone kind of suspected they were a little covert and a little saboteur-like, but no one expected they would be so widely embedded in all the legions just to flip a kill switch, you know?
Yep.
They even say it later in the book. The loyalists are winning with three legions. Ferris's plan was going very well.
Yeah, it was.
Anything you wanted to add before we tuck into the battles itself?
No, I think that rounds out the start of the book very well. Like, there's a lot of staging and setup. There's a lot of setting the scene and the emotions that are in play. And I think they did a good job of that in a very repetitive manner.
Yeah. But boy howdy, the battle.
Yeah.
A good third of this book, at least, is the three loyalist legions in the first wave.
Kicking
ass. Touching down, going to war, and kicking ass. And they got their Solar Auxiliary buddies being like, holy moly.
Right? Yeah. They hit the ground running, and they push all the way to the walls of the fortress. There's some really interesting scenes in here. Some Fabius play. You've got, you know, the display of the Noise Marines kind of showing up and doing their thing. There's some...
Oh, yeah. The Sonic EMP.
Yeah. There's some very neat scenes that describe how far the Emperor's children have fallen. For the most part, yeah, the Loyalists are kicking ass.
I really liked how they explained the various legions doing war. They really highlighted how the Iron Hands were so mechanically tuned into their war plans that their focus was tank vanguard forces that were just cracking targets left, right, and center. If there was a fortress emplacement that had retargeted their weapons to take out the Iron Hand tanks, the Iron Hand tanks would recalculate their attack vectors to blow up the gun emplacements before pushing in to secure landing zones. The Raven Guard were en masse. I think it said their entire legion was deployed with drop pods and landing craft, and then just blood, like an unkindness, into all the various warrens and underground tunnels, and we're just guerrilla fighting like crazy, ambushing Sons of Horus without too much fuss. The salamanders just landed, and it's described that they were just like a lake of lava just pouring over the battlefield, and it was so cool. I really liked it. I was back in.
And one thing we did kind of skip over a little bit is the confrontation between Horus and
Angron,
which was honestly one of my favorite moments in the whole book. That individual confrontation between the two, where Horus is like, brother, I get it, but we have to do this. And you can't be the one to interrupt these plans. And Angron's like, if I can't do warfare, I will just fight you instead. And they have this like mini matchup that just really shows how strong both of them are, and that Horus is definitely the War Master for a reason.
Yeah, that was a fantastic scene. Malagurst, Horus's equerry, had tried to convince Khan to be the voice of reason in Angron's head. Angron's exceptionally upset about betraying his brothers so insidious-like. And so he's going to their Astronomicon beacon to just straight up be like, hey, it's a trap.
Just to let them know.
Which I thought was really nice. He wasn't going to not fight them, but he's going to do it with nobility. Bit of corn there. I like that he's going towards this beacon. Khan's like, Dad, please, don't go. Angron's like, you fucking dare, bitch son, and just sends him across the sands with one back end. And then Horus is just standing there like the final boss, like a Dark Souls boss. Like, where did he come from?
Yeah, right? He just shows up.
He was in the war room with Angron. Angron leaves, and then Angron's moving towards the thing, and Horus is before him. I'm like, where did he come from?
Teleported.
But yeah, that was a fantastic scene, you're right.
Yeah, and I just didn't want to skip over that.
No, you're good. The line that really stuck with me was Angron just painfully yelling out, why is there never a choice?
Yeah, why is Angron the voice of reason for the traitors right now?
Well, he always was. He's always seen as the frothing madman, right? Like, no one could pass his rage.
Yeah.
And Horus, such a dick. He's like, yeah, I hear you, but I don't fucking care.
He's like, I get what you're saying, but this is the only way we can win. And sure enough, it was the only way they could win. If the loyalists knew it was a trap, everything would have gone very differently.
Yeah. What did you think of the battle as a whole, taking up so much of this book? You already mentioned Bolter Pawnee, but how did you enjoy the battle itself? And I definitely have a point to make, but I want to hear your opinion.
I enjoyed a lot of the individual moments, but felt exhausted by the end.
Yep.
Trying to both keep track of who was where and doing what, and also like just how much of it was this person's shooting, this person's, you know, like the actual Bolter side of things where it's just warfare. But anytime they jumped to an individual character doing something a little more interesting, I really enjoyed it. Seeing the Alpha Legion kind of doing their thing in the background and influencing things and all of that was really fun, especially towards the end, where they really give you the old whose side are they on treatment. But yeah, no, it was fun, but it was a lot.
Absolutely. I really like certain scenes as well. As you pointed out, the individual character moments were really cool. I was a big fan of moments such as Kaede's Next, the Moritat Prime, basically a Space Marine lone commando who,
yep,
his whole point is, like, I'm going to assassinate the chain of command. And he ends up in a fight against Horus Axeman until I think bombs start going off and he gets knocked about. And seeing him engage with such lethal precision, just point blank popping domes, was really fun. My favorite was probably the Salamander Legionary, I think his name was Arrasus, who just by sheer chance managed to keep surviving engagement after engagement. But by the end of the book, he's describing himself as donning a Death Guard helmet or something to that nature. He's picking up weapons from the dead because he's just running out of ammo. And he's just muttering to himself like the Promethean Cree, like the Salamander war cries and prayers and such, because it's so overwhelming that all he can do is calm himself down and focus on what's right in front of him. There's a lot of these little moments where there's a lot of push and pull. Arrasus gets in a bit of a pickle, only to be saved by Salamander Saturnine Terminators or Dreadnoughts or what have you. And you think, oh yeah, cool. And then the next time you see them, there's a strange fog rolling over and it's gas clouds. You're like, oh, that seems familiar. And then they mention a big old scythe coming out of the gas clouds and the Saturnines being cleaved in half. You're like, oh, it's Mortarion.
Yeah.
From the perspective of Arrasus, you see Mortarion coming through, and just as he's going to cleave through the last one, a big old fucking hammer knocks it out of the air or clangs into the air. Then the Legionary's like, oh, it's Vulcan.
And those moments were really cool, like seeing the godlike Primarchs being seen and just like showing up in such big ways and turning the fight in different areas. That was the cool stuff.
I would have loved a little bit more of that. I'm unsure if it would have taken away from the impact or not if we focus more on the bigger characters. There was a really funny moment when Kaede's Next was about to be dealt with forever. Can't have that, he's a named character. And so little Horus and his dudes end up fleeing because the Raven's coming. And it just seems so funny to have these trained killers be like, oh no, the Raven. And you're thinking, the Raven? The bird? Oh, the Primarch.
No, the Primarch himself.
That would be pretty scary.
Yep. It was cool, and there were some really cool moments.
My big issue that I came to think by the end of the book and passing through the second wave stuff, but sort of combining the two into a thought, is I think we got a lot more details about the battle itself compared to, say, the Isfahan 3 stuff. From a sort of a clinical recap standpoint, I suppose that's better, but it didn't feel nearly as emotional as with Loken and Tarvitz and all of those characters like Tor'Gadon, the Death Guard with the Huron Fowl moment.
Yeah.
It seemed written more consistently across the whole book, but I was so much more invested in Galaxy and Flames
I think there's two reasons for that. Partially, we got to know those characters in books beforehand. They built up those characters a bit, so when they were under pressure, we were already relating to their experiences, whereas a lot of the characters in this book that weren't Primarchs were fairly new to the scene, at least for us, you know, like, probably got other novels and all of this, but especially for me, coming from only having really read the first five books of the Horus Heresy, those characters weren't really here, and occasionally one would pop up, and you'd be like, hey, it's the guy. But yeah, I think the other part of it is, we already know the outcome of what's going to happen. We've been in 40K for a while now, so it's really hard to be like, oh my god, they might lose.
Gee, I hope Ferris Manus makes it.
Yeah, right? Like, you know what's coming.
Which is why I really like the start of the books. It felt a little poetic and dreamy, as if it knows the epic tragedy that's about to occur. But then when it gets into the battle, it felt like something I've listened to before, but probably with a bit more overwhelming death and destruction. But the last 2 hours of the book, a bit decisive.
Divisive?
Split opinions. That's it. Thank you. English is hard today.
English is hard every day.
Yeah. A little divisive from what I've gathered from community. Can't imagine why.
You can't?
Second wave, the betrayal, it felt a little milquetoast in comparison to what just came beforehand. Like, and they're betraying them now. Okay.
I knew this was coming, but all right.
Yeah, I suppose the massacre was the first wave then. The whole book, you're kind of waiting for just the sheer massacre of that first wave. And whilst it definitely is touched upon, and you could tell it's not going to go well, and there are moments like when the word bearers touch down and they're just mowing down Raven Guard. You're like, I get it. I get they're losing.
This is the part that I thought was very, very well done in Fulgrim.
Yeah.
Was the second wave. Seeing in Fulgrim, you had like the perspective of the fallback, and then them being like, oh shit, everyone behind us is set up, and now they're just shooting into us as the Iron Warriors landed and reinforced the landing zones. And that scene in Fulgrim was so cool to me and so brutally decisive on the battle that I was shocked that it wasn't better portrayed in this. Like, it kind of felt like there wasn't a fallback so much, whereas in Fulgrim, it felt like the Imperial forces were starting to fall back when the second wave came. This felt more like they just landed behind them and came up their bumhole, which was a bit weird to me. I think they really should have focused more on that emotional turn in the last part of the book, that, oh no, what's going on?
Yeah, the loyalists didn't feel, to me, particularly surprised. I mean, sure, they're in the exhaustion of battle, but it was just kind of like, oh, Night Lords are attacking us now. Poo-poo, poo-poo. Oh, yeah. The Word Bearers are attacking us. Let's fight them anyway.
That should have been the big emotional turn point moment, like, for the loyalists to really drive home that they have been betrayed again a second time. Because that's kind of the vibe I get from Dropsite Massacre, is it's the, oh, this is so much bigger than it should be. This is so much worse than we thought. This isn't a quarter of the legions. This is half of them. And considering the legions that are suddenly betraying, like, it should have been a very big moment of, oh, I know they were bad, but oh damn. Word bearers had been sanctioned already. The Night Lords were always kind of a bit weird. The Iron Warriors were definitely doing some weird stuff, and Perturabo was always a man-child about it. The Alpha Legion should have definitely been a surprise, but at the same time, it's like, oh no, they're so ingrained in our legions. Like, there should have been so many big shock moments, and it kind of felt like they missed the ball on that one.
They kind of all but said in the build-up with the Iron Warriors and the Alpha Legions especially, like, they're going to betray you. They had people on the ship being like, you got to move this ship into a different position, or we are taking over. Or an Alpha Legion saying to a Salamander's buddy after being sleeper agent unlocked, hey, draw your sword, buddy.
It's time. I got to do this.
it's time. And I think the Alpha Legion stuff was done quite well because, you know, you knew the Iron Warriors were going to betray because they were just very matter of fact, like, move your ships. Perdurabo's planned us all out.
They're like really dickish about it too, which I liked.
And all the Exiliae were like, hold on a second. This doesn't quite work.
Technically, you're above us, but something sus is here.
The Raven Guard Master of Descent was like, no, I don't trust you. And so you can kind of get the idea like, oh, it's going to happen. But it wasn't until Mr. Ingo Peck himself, blam, into the Iron Warriors guy in a skull. I thought that was really funny. Yeah, he studied a long time the weak points in the armor of the Mark II plate. Did you know that around the ear, behind the fold of the skin, there's a port? Just like, anyway, bolt gun.
Yep.
And I liked that the ship commander, was, huh? Excuse me? And Ingo Peck's like, yes, well, it's a betrayal. And they're like, why are you telling us? Because you have a choice. Are you not a traitor then? And they're like, well, yes and no. We don't want everyone to die. That's just silly. You know,
someone needs to go back and tell them what happened.
We need conflict here. We need to sow the seeds a little longer. You know, we can't just have everyone fucking die. Are you kidding? And the Auxilia are like, okay. Thanks, I guess.
Yeah, right. Which is definitely the only vibe you should get from Alpha Warriors, from Alpha Legion is, okay, why are you doing this? Because nobody ever knows what they're up to.
Yeah, this is one of those moments where knowing the other novels works quite well. I think book 7 or 8 in the Heresy was Legion. It's an Alpha Legion focused account. And not to really give away too much of the book, but in it, they come across this Xenos Cabal. I think they actually just call themselves the Cabal. And they basically give the Primarchs of the Alpha Legion this sort of vision of the future, except they don't really know which chain of events will lead to it. They don't know if the Loyalists winning or the Traitors winning will lead to that future. And so they go into overdrive mode with the plans upon plans and try and hold a stalemate for as long as they can. Because, you know, I think we do like the Emperor, but change is required. You know, the Star Wars prophecy, like the Chosen One will bring balance to the Force. And then by the third movie, you're like, hold on a minute. The balance is overwhelmingly in favor of the Jedi. What balance are they talking about?
Yep.
And I think the Alpha Legion unfortunately fall into that trap despite their best intentions in this book.
But they were some of the more interesting moments in the book.
Absolutely.
Because there was questions, there was it felt more like betrayal and plans on plans, and yeah, I think they handled Alpha Legion very well in this.
Did we miss anything?
Oh, I mean, not really, right? Drop Site Massacre.
Dear CRA, Johnny.
Oh, dear CRA.
Whatever.
Me whatever. Specifically being like, anytime a Titan shows up, it's dear CRA, and then you go listen to the next part of the book, and it's dear CRA.
Yeah. It was all right. It was nice to see the sort of echoes in the machine from the previous pilot that Mr. Arukin betrayed, sort of toying with him only for the voice to be chaos of some description. Oh, that's something I really liked. Both DS ERA and the various individual components of the Legio and Khan simultaneously at the crux of the battle had Chaos talking to them. And Mr. Jonathan Keeble, chef's kiss with the deep, evil demon voices.
Yeah, right. Dude was on fire.
I really liked the only real word bearers moment where Cor Faeron, that dickhead, basically orchestrating a firing line, but they describe the firing line as being in tune with his oration, his hymns to the gods.
Oh, yep.
For the 4, for the 8, you know, doing a little Macarena chant, and all the guns are like, for the 4, for the 8. And you're like, that's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, for sure.
Another moment I really liked was when, what was his name, Alvarex Morn, the Master of Descent, basically the guy in charge of logistics, picking up Corvus from Battlezone when it was very obvious that he needed to get out, and even the Night Lord's fighter pilot chasing him was like, wow, that was really impressive. How did you manage to drop so danger close, pick up a bunch of people, and then get out before I've shot him? That's really crazy. Anyway, have a rocket, bitch. Yeah, that was really cool. And he's like, you know what? Not only will I take down Alvarex Morn, but I'm going to take out the Primarch.
I'll be the first one to kill a Primarch.
You go, Night Lord. There's a really wonderful short story, or an audio drama. I think it's called The Raven's Flight. It's like 40, 50 minutes long. And it's set later in all of this when Corvus and his surviving like 4,000 or 5,000 Marines have just gone yeet out into the desert and are doing all like hidey holes and hit and run tactics because they can't leave. But as they say
guerrilla
in this book,
warfare.
The thousands that are alive are no matter. But Corvus is on the planet.
He feels like he matters.
Yeah, they portray this vibe that they have no ammunition left. Like, they're done.
Yep.
They're depleted. Yep. The World Eaters are marching for them, but they've managed to just bleed them. And Corvus has no bullets either. He's fighting by, like, picking up rocks and hurling them as bullets through the air, cracking skulls. But he's throwing rocks. Like, that's how desperate he gets.
He is a superhuman, so...
But can you imagine, demigod of war, hit and run out in the desert against several enemies at once, and he's got rocks. There's another short story, which is still this thing, and I really wish moments like this were more chucked into this book, because how often are you going to go and come across the short stories? But...
Never!
It might be in Raven's Flight. I don't know. But in the Drop Site Massacre, Corvus gets like centimeters away from impaling Lorgar.
Nice.
Corvus manages to ambush Lorgar during the Drop Site Massacre and almost kills him. I think he even manages to shank him. But before he can deliver the final blow, Kurz of the Night Lords parries Corvus and is like, I can't let you do that, brother. Then Corvus is like, oh, I can't take on two of them. Caw-caw, bye!
Retreats.
But moments like that are so monumental.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not in this. Who cares if you're retelling? Put it in!
Not only that, like, if they had sped through the drop site, they might have had time to go through what happened afterwards, because the only real scene that we get after the drop site is... from Horus's side of things, as Fulgrim shows back up.
Somehow. He came back from book 5.
Just in time to drop Ferris Manus's head off for Horus himself.
What was the message I sent to you when I finished it? And then Ingo Peck, totally not Alpharius, wholesomely let one ship go. Ferris Manus is like really dead. Super dead. Fabius is gooning about it, actually. And yeah, see you next time. Ba-ba-bum. Or you know what? Ba ba bum. This makes book 55. Ba wa wa. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this recording. And that's it. That's how it ends.
And that's it. That's it. That's Drop Site Massacre.
A lot of good stuff, but I'm definitely a bit colder on it than I wished I was. And that's only because I feel like, for as good as the book was, I'm not sure if it was maybe like an editorial thing. Hey, just make it nice and sweet, like just wrap it up, neat little bow, nothing too crazy. Or if it was just like, John, can you hurry up? This is John French, by the way, not Johnny Boy. John, can you please just get this out for us? Like, it really needs to come out, you know? And John's like, yeah, you had me write 3 books this year, hold on.
Yeah, they definitely work him to the bone.
Ah, it came back to me why I think this is also meant to be a third edition tie-in book, because...
Oh, yeah?
Think of it. The book ends at the back half of the massacre, where the second wave is ambushing them, right?
Yes.
if you look at the Horus Heresy 3rd edition Battle Force, it's the Dropsite Massacre stuff. The Arcane Journals, or the Journal Tacticas that come out later, are things like the Ruin of the Salamanders. So, like, everything that happens against the Traitor second wave, quite plausibly, are the missions in the game books.
Ah, interesting.
Bit of a play the book and then determine what happens for yourself, you know? And yeah. I could be stretching, but that's what it felt like to me.
That doesn't seem like much of a stretch, honestly.
Fair enough. But yeah, lots of good things. Another couple of little moments that I really liked. I really liked Malagurst in this. He's actually my favorite of the Sons of Horus characters, despite being a little evil asshole. But Malagurst, at some point when Horus had basically given the go order to the second wave to betray, he even says, "Would you like to see this for yourself, Mal?" And Mal said, "No, thank you," and didn't watch. I thought that was really interesting. Like, he doesn't really want the violence. He just wants Horus's victory.
Yeah, he's there to support Horus. He's not there to go kill a bunch of people.
And my second little honorable mention scene is my homeboy, Exodus, the one who is many, the Alpha Legion sniper.
Oh, yeah.
At the end, he's deployed on the ridges. It's 3 kilometers away, which I think's crazy. And he's watching a few salamanders just wander a little aimlessly around. And then he sees Night Lords approaching them. The Night Lords' war cry is, "We have come for you." And so if you're the salamanders, they might have been like, "Oh, friends." Exodus, the sniper, realizes what's about to occur and needs to keep that status quo going. So he shoots the Night Lords, like 3 in a row, boom, boom, boom. Then the Night Lords are like, "Oh, crap," and go to fight the salamanders. But this gives the salamanders enough time to not be ambushed and fight back. Bloody hell. These Alpha Legions, eh? They were the guys that fed false intelligence to basically get this first wave on the battlefield in the first place. Any other moments of yours that you really liked?
I think we pretty much covered everything that drew my attention.
Probably the only other perspective that we've glossed over is the Auxiliary woman. I think her name was Astrea. Just a high-ranking member of the Ground Command. And her whole issue is that she has this message in a scroll that she hasn't read because she's afraid of what it says, but she never gets to read it because everything in this book happens in 4 hours, just about, like, the actual fighting on the field, about 4 hours. And so the whole time the Auxiliary are just bouncing between, "Oh my God, how can we keep up with the Astartes?" to, "Oh my God, the tables have turned," to, "Oh my God, we can't fight that." And then you really feel for them after a while. You're like, "Oh, you poor punching bags."
Yeah, you're there just to make the Space Marines look real good.
Oh, and Casterman Orth, the only real Iron Hands character, the tank commander. I thought he was pretty cool, but when he gets blown up, more or less, I like that when he comes back to consciousness, he is not really good. He's paralyzed. He doesn't know which part of his body is not there anymore. He just doesn't feel things quite correctly. There was a moment where his iron hand, his prosthetic, isn't working, and he thought that was quite poetic because his real hand does. And all he can really tune into the scanners of the tank, only for Fabius and Capernaum to be like, "G'day!
How you doing?
Hey, you want to see something neat? Hi, look, it's the head of your Primarch." And then Casterman Orth has a PTSD blackout.
Yep.
Poor guy. But really cool tank commander vibes with his moments. Far out. I think that's everyone.
I think that's it.
I think that's everyone. There was a Salamander's dreadnought that knew Horus because he used to lead the Legion before Vulcan. I thought that was interesting. But again, like, moments like that, like, have him meet Horus and have an actual fight with him. Make him lose. But he never got to talk to Horus. I was waiting for that the whole book because he keeps having flashbacks to Horus and him being like, We'll take over the world for the Emperor and we'll have a beautiful life, my friend. Anyway, not too bad. What do you give it out of 10? What do you give it out of 10, Joe?
I want to make a joke here and it's a terrible joke.
All right. 6 or 7?
Maybe like a 6-7.
6-7?
But honestly, like, that's roughly where I would put it, is in the 6 to 7 category range. Like, it's a good book. It just wasn't my necessary cup of tea. Mm-hmm. It's not a book I'd, like, go back to and reread.
I get you. The start of the book made me feel like I was in for a nice 9 out of 10. If the book had more of the things we've already mentioned in the back third, I could probably keep it around the 8 or 9 out of 10, but I'm going to have to go down to a 7 for what I perceive as a bit of missed opportunities. Like, there's a lot of good stuff. It's quite serviceable. There's some neat moments, but I can't help but feel this one's a bit optional.
Yes. That's definitely the way I feel too. Like, you could skip this and not lose out on much in the Horus Heresy as long as you've read Fulgrim.
Yeah, I think even the first heretic with the word bearers ends up back at this moment in time anyway.
Oh, does it?
I think so. Like, you get a lot of little perspectives of it. So if you miss this book, who cares?
Yeah, this kind of felt like a culmination of the books that touch on it. While focusing on the perspectives that aren't focused in those individual novels, right?
Yeah, I saw a review that basically pushed this as a love letter to those who've read the other books. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what's our next one, Joshy?
Oh, I think in our little cycle of things, I think it's my turn to actually, like, pick the book. I can just choose one.
And what would you like to choose for us to read next?
Ooh,
surely you've got something lined up.
I've got too many things lined up, Johnny. It's a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I want to put in something that I already know about. Something that I know is pretty good. Books that I would rate quite highly. And I think one that a lot of the community would rate quite highly. Let us continue with Mr. Jonathan Keeble's great narration and check out Hell's Reach.
Hell's Reach.
Hell's Reach.
That's a IG novel, isn't it?
Gets a little more interesting for you, Johnny. It's a Black Templars novel.
Oh, okay. All right. We're going crusading.
Well, the framing of Hell's Reach is that this is from the Space Marine Battles series from many, many, many moons ago, back when the setting was still pretty static. Everything just happened around the same time. So the Space Marine Battles were a bunch of Space Marine vignettes that really set the scenes for things that are still kind of raging on today, or filled in a lot of the blanks about the legions that we now understand today. Hell's Reach is the War for Armageddon.
Oh, which one?
I think it's the second. I think it's the third. I think it's the third.
Do you love that? Yeah. First question. Which War for Armageddon? That place has been in conflict its whole life.
I think it's the third. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the third because I'm fairly certain Yarrick isn't really a character. So, probably third. But what it is, is that it's Chaplain Grimaldus. He has been recently elevated to High Chaplain of the Black Templars. The Black Templars' fleet have been summoned to Armageddon to help defend it against the Orcs. They're getting ready for the next big war. And High Marshal Helbrecht basically commands Chaplain Grimaldus to take control of Hive Hell's Reach, and Grimaldus basically views this as a death sentence and really struggles. His little command squad with him also struggles because their spiritual leader has kind of consigned himself to oblivion a little bit. But then over the course of the book, there's a lot of minor victories, a lot of losses, and the whole book is Grimaldus just finding his fire and uniting all the various elements of the Hive, the common folk, his marines. Salamanders show up at one point. There's a couple of titans that he basically strong arms into helping him. And it's just this extremely defiant defense of a singular city on Armageddon. And it's quite poignant. I really like it. I've actually listened to it twice and watch the animated movie version once or twice.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. I hope that's a good sales pitch for you there, Johnny.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So you guys get on to reading Hell's Reach by Mr. Aaron Dembski Bowden, performed by, I really hope it's Jonathan Keeble now that I've said it, but I'm like 99% sure. And we'll get that discussion out at the very end of March. In the meantime, you're more than welcome to join our Discord and hop in on chats of this novel, The Drop Site Massacre. And until Hell's Reach comes out, you can do non-spoilery chit-chats about that one on the Discord too.
Yeah, come say hi.
Link in bio after the description.
Nice, nice. And yes, it is narrated by Jonathan Keeble.
I know my stuff.
All right, well, everyone have a lovely week / weekend / you know, whenever it takes for us to get to this next episode. And we'll see you around.
Peace out for the Emperor or for Horus. Let us know.
Obviously, it's for the Chaos Gods.
Whatever command word the Alpha Legion tells me at the time.